coming up, Dane Cook joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas, and you are watching the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. My lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
And we are live. This is our first live show. It's very exciting. God knows what will happen. But we're going back to Jerry Lewis days of telethon, live telethon, sort
right?
of an homage
yes.
To the great king of comedy, Jerry Lewis, our good friend.
A good friend of yours who recently passed.
Yes, he did.
And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about
sure.
your relationship with him. So I had, you know, my experience of Jerry Lewis was telethons when I was a kid.
Right.
And then, you know, the screwball comedy movies where he was always very, you know, he had a lot of physical comedy involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was just sort of a clown in the kindest sense of the word, you know, in the most generous way.
Right.
Very, you know, wonderful for kids. Like, as a kid, I just loved him because mm-hmm. I thought he was so exciting to watch, right? And so now you worked with him.
We worked together. First of all, I'm going to go to the Jerry Seinfeld, the other Jerry Seinfeld mm-hmm. quote about Jerry Lewis. And there's some incredible documentaries about his work. But he said, you know, quite famously, if you don't think Jerry Lewis is funny, then you don't know anything about comedy. And, you know, just to watch his relationship with, you know, Dean Martin,
right.
One of the greatest comedy duos of all time, his movie work, his directing work, and, you know, getting to know him through doing this film, Max Rose, but also, you know, the way the friendship really developed was through my work on Turner Classic Movies, and what we're going to do on Monday, September 4th, is there's going to be an all-day tribute to Jerry, and we're going to be showing all of
wow.
his films, and there's going to be an interview that Ben Mankiewicz did with him, and Ben and I will be discussing him throughout the day in between the films. And I think a lot of those discussions too are going to concentrate on some of those aspects of what made him so great for a modern audience.
So that TCM event, is that something that is going to be shot and aired?
We have already shot it, and it will be airing.
It airs on Monday.
Monday,
nice.
On Labor
okay.
Day in honor of him. And it was, you know, such an honor. Those are some of my favorite moments, of course, were being able to interview him for Turner Classic Movies and to take some of the private discussions that we had about film and put them on for people, especially just his innovations in terms of...
That was the exact word that was coming to me. He was a
yes.
great innovator when it came to filmmaking, especially in his time.
In his time, the use of the Nagra recorder, of course, the video assist, which he used on The Bellboy.
Mm-hmm.
He loved gadgets and you know, all of those different things. But just the creating of going all the way back, the creating of the act with Dean Martin and what that entailed, and going to Paramount and working for Hal Wallace and learning everything about the studio, and then slowly but surely the directors that he was working with started to give him, you know, a dance number to kind of second unit direct, and that's how, you know, it just started to grow with him. And so, you know, although it's sad that they split up, and we talk about his favorite film, which was The Stooge, which was really a kind of an interesting example of their relationship, because that's the only movie where Dean Martin is kind of the bad guy and Jerry Lewis is sort of the funny, sympathetic one. And it, mm-hmm. it kind of foreshadows, you know, what happened with their relationship. But what I said about Jerry and with Ben, which I think, again, makes him so interesting as a comic, is that for me, aside from the directing, as a comedy persona, he and Dean Martin had sex appeal. And when
Absolutely.
I think of all the comedy people I saw growing up, but whether it's the Three Stooges or Abbott and Costello,
mm-hmm.
you know, Laurel and Hardy, you know, they didn't have sex appeal. But
right.
but Dean and Jerry, you know, they looked nice. They they danced with girls. There was a musicality about them. Mm-hmm. And there was what everybody describes as this kind of post-war enthusiasm. They were right before the Beatles. To me, they were like America's Beatles. You know, girls love them. And you could imagine yourself being with Dean or with Jerry. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that's what made them so popular. And I think that it worked with kids, but then it also, you know, if you really study comedy and see some of the innovations that he made, his use of color, the use of music, all in his film, some of the sight gags. And also in a movie like The Bellboy, which we talk about, I think he may be one of the very first people who kind of made fun of, had a separate persona as Jerry Lewis, you know, in making fun of himself. Where so he plays Stanley, the bellboy, but then he also plays the uber narcissistic Jerry Lewis who comes and stays at the hotel. And this was years before, you know, what we now think of, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm and Larry Sanders and even, you know, Mel Brooks to a certain extent, breaking the fourth wall and looking at the camera and creating a kind of obnoxious persona. This was something he was doing back in the early 60s. So it'll be a great time, I think, to re-examine some of his, you know, some of his work. And I know in some instances, you know, again, people, you know, had very negative feelings about his comedy or didn't think he was funny. And I just strongly disagree with that.
So what was it like the first time you met him?
I just think that, again, this is someone who had a natural instinct if you wanted to learn about comedy. The very first conversation we ever had was a lengthy discussion about Jack Benny, you know, and the early television shows of Jack Benny. And I think that if you had a knowledge and a curiosity about those things, he was a great mentor and could pick up on that and would explain, you know, again, things that he did.
Well, and I would imagine for someone like him, so many people come up to him and they only know one facet of everything that he has done. Mm-hmm. And so when someone comes up like you, because I can see you two as being really kindred spirits because you have such an intense knowledge and craving for understanding when it comes to film in all aspects, that he could really relate to that. And I can imagine sitting fly on the wall with you two.
I mean, I had a deep respect for him. You know, I just, again, growing up, I just thought he was funny. And I, you know, I was not as aware of the telethon because, again, just growing up as a hippie, we weren't really allowed to have television or watch TV. So I was aware of it, but I became aware of the Martin and Lewis movies because they would play on television. And I loved, like, I think Artists and Models was my personal favorite because it was always like they were cute and they danced and Shirley MacLaine is in it. And it has all the aspects that, that a girl would like too. Mm-hmm. But, when I met Martin Scorsese, I was obsessed with King of Comedy, you know, like everybody is now, it's a cult movie. And but even back when it first came, you know, I was there opening day when it first came out with Elias Koteas, and we loved it then. And so asking Marty just a lot of questions about somebody like Jerry Lewis, we didn't have the internet then, so you couldn't rely. I wasn't aware until Marty told me all of the innovations that he had made and that he had a live television show and so all those sort of things. So I think, again, initially when I met Jerry, it was just this idea of confirming things that I had read or stories, again, that, you know, that Marty had told me about King of Comedy and some of the great contributions he made to the film, assisting with a lot of the live television scenes. I think I told the story with Ben, is that there's a very famous scene in King of Comedy where the woman is, you know, speak to my nephew, please. And he's walking along the street and he keeps walking and the woman says, you should get cancer. And they were doing that and they couldn't get the timing right. And Marty's the type of director who just said, Jerry, and it had really happened to Jerry. So he said, you direct it. You just tell her when to. And so, like, he had such a sense of timing that he knew exactly when he wanted her to say it. Mm-hmm. And when I had met Marty, I love timing and sound. It's one of my favorite things. And so that was the first thing, regardless of Jerry Lewis, I asked him. I said, how did you get that woman? It's so funny. She says it on Right the Thing. He said, oh, that was all Jerry. snapped exactly when he wanted her, you know, to say it. And again, being privileged to see Jerry in Damn Yankees, mm-hmm. where he would, I've never seen anything like it before or since, where he would literally stop the show, come down stage, do jokes with the audience, and then go back in character. And people went nuts, you know, and he had that ability to, again, break the fourth wall and be Jerry and then go back and also, you know, be in the movies. So it was, you know, and then again, also just talking about some of the things that were so surprising was he loved Edith Head.
And the costume designer.
I'm a huge Edith Head mm-hmm. fan. She ran Paramount. He, you know, I love clothing. And again, just in terms of historical references, to know that Jerry Lewis said to me, I never made a move without Edith Head. Wow. Whenever I cast an actress, I brought her in. We discussed every outfit. You know, he went through Nutty Professor with me, literally every single outfit that Stella Stevens is wearing and why she's wearing it. And this color is this and why color is important. And things that I hadn't, and of course, you know, then he taught a class. I mean, we had Randall Kleiser here.
I listened to the Randall Kleiser podcast, you guys, because there's a lot of, they talk a lot about Jerry and that.
And I think that, you know, again, the public persona of him is very different. You know, his off-camera persona was that of someone that was very thoughtful, very generous, very helpful to me. Gave me a lot of confidence in terms of my own comedy and my own, you know, writing and my own career as a director. And it just was, you know, as I said, it's tough not to have that kind of mentorship of someone who is actually there, who dealt with the studio heads, who you know, suffered the slings and arrows, had the highest highs and some of the lowest lows. And as I said in my Twitter in regards to him, that he, my favorite thing about Jerry is that he embodies for me everything I love about show business. He is comedy and he is tragedy, and the combination of that is pathos, and that is the great combination that any comedian has. And he had, if you look at his work, I mean, because you know me, I love dancing and I love musicality. What he had for me is musicality in his body. And in his, you know, the way he did his comedy. And whereas Chaplin could be very precious almost, and I loved, you know, he certainly had the pathos. But what Jerry had was this use of his body, but also when he went into these dance numbers, it was like, oh man,
brilliant.
This is just, you know, great. So
well, so have everybody take a look for the TCM special.
Yes, TCM all
on
day
on
Monday, and you can celebrate Mr. Lewis. There's so many videos that are coming out too.
Let's bring in Dane.
I'm going to bring in Dane Cook, who is another amazing comedian who also manages to use his body on stage. These are all the great comedy albums he's done. Harmful If Swallowed, Retaliation, Vicious Circle, Rough Around the Edges, Live from Madison Square Garden. Of course, he is an actor. I remember your very first movie, Employee of the Month, Good Luck Chuck, Dan in Real Life, which I love, Mr. Brooks, which I love, and I just saw American Exit last night, and here is my good friend. We're going to get to the movie that we're in. Look at that picture of you. Yikes.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah, I made them, I told them to make sure and keep that one in. They were gonna
look at me.
Out. No, I'm
2 weeks ago that was taken.
I know, I thought it was on your way here.
That
actually.
Is amazing.
You arrived shirtless.
Wait,
I pulled over, I jumped in the ocean real quick.
You said
my friend's a photog and we threw that up on the internet. I'm in the best shape of my week.
That is amazing. Do you like being in good shape? It's tough as you get older.
Can I just say before I even answer that question, how I'm very honored to be here and thank you so much for asking me to be a part of this.
Thrilled.
It means a lot. Now I have to go.
Oh, sorry. You're going to be like Bob Hope. He's going to be like, you're off. Well, we've known each other for a long time, but we haven't seen each other that much.
Right. It's an interesting, our origin tale is kind of fascinating.
Do tell.
Well, I almost brought, you know, I have an autographed picture from you even. You don't even remember.
I don't remember this.
Right. Just when you were starting. Well, we met on, we're going to get to this because we're going to go in order. Okay. But we met on a movie and you were lovely and we had a lot of fun, even though neither one of us has seen the movie.
I've never seen the movie.
And Lucy Liu won't acknowledge it, but we'll get to that. Then I saw you do stand up, like right. very early on.
Yes.
And I remember, and I had an 8x10. I had it signed. I should have brought it with you.
Because my old headshots are, wow. I had some really good bad ones.
You had a good, no, you look good. You had the black t-shirt and the black jeans.
Okay,
good. It was very 90s, good. I think.
That was my mom's idea. She was like, you should wear a black tank top on stage. And I was like, yeah, I don't know if that's not dressy enough. And she was like, no, it shows off your limbs. People want to see you move.
I love it. Well, I was just talking about Jerry Lewis before. He said he had such great use of his body.
Yeah.
And what
I mean, great use. It's unbelievable what he did.
Well, you know, I was saying to on TCM, we're doing an all day. We're going to show a bunch of his movies.
Yeah.
And it didn't occur to Ben. Because it's so funny, he doesn't understand how women think. I said, for me, Dean and Jerry, they had sex appeal. Abbott and Costello and Three Stooges. But like Dean and Jerry, even when I was a kid and you watch them on TV, you could sort of imagine. It's like the Beatles. You sort of picked which one you wanted to be with.
Yeah, I mean, I remember feeling like I wanted to emulate both of them. I didn't feel particularly handsome when I was a kid. And I wish I could be Dean. And I love that Jerry was so ballsy in terms of... It always felt like, wow, he's really taking this thing off the rails.
Yes.
You know, there's actually I went to the television museum down there, the one in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And one day I was just watching copious Jerry. This is like 10 years ago, and I'm watching all these episodes of his talk show that he did.
Oh, amazing!
Which was a mess, but the best kind of mess.
Yeah.
It was like 3 hours of just like, you know, as they went, they were kind of going with the flow. But I'll never forget this. It might be my favorite. You know, pratfall slapstick moment, and it was unbelievable. He had a stage that when the curtain opened from his silhouette, he was standing on the edge of a stage moving him down towards the the lip.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of, you know, standing there mugging. And as it's going towards the front, it starts moving faster, and then it goes over the lip and it stops, and he flies out into the audience. Like, on somebody's table. It didn't look rehearsed. They had no clue. They were freaking out.
Wow.
I mean, he must have, like, really busted his hip up. Really
I'm sure right he there. Did. Is to, you know, later all the, you know,
what
the,
we'll do for
the
a laugh.
Back right? issues
yes.
and stuff.
That's true.
All right, so we're going to get to Jerry, but let's go back to my favorite question. Do you remember the first film you saw?
Yes.
And who took you to see it?
Okay, this still is being disputed
yes?
in my family, and here's why. Because I have two memories, and I don't know which one happened first, but we went to a drive-in. My mom, my dad, myself, and I think my older sister, Kelly. Mm-hmm. And there was a movie called Lipstick.
Yes, Margot Hemingway.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. 77. Well, I mean, the description of the movie, if you look on Wikipedia, it's let me read this. Because I had to look it up today to be like, did I really see that movie when I was... And where is it?
It's a great little kids film, isn't it?
Ready? Here's the log line from Wikipedia. Lipstick is a 1976 American rape and revenge thriller.
Oh, my God.
And I was four, and they took me to see this film. So I remember being in the back seat and just being completely kerfuffled by what was happening. The movie I remember having the impact and changed my life was Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's the first movie that I remember seeing in a theater, at the Capitol Theater in Arlington, Massachusetts. And I was, like, mesmerized.
Yeah. There's something about the first movie you see. It just has... It does something to you. I don't know why.
The whole experience of going into a theater and, you know, the lights going down. And who are all these people? You feel like you're strangers, and then suddenly you have something in common as you're rooting together for these
characters.
It had a visceral reaction immediately that I needed.
I remember, did you have that experience? I know, and I'm a little older than you. We were part of the return film generation with Jaws.
Okay.
Because it was like, that was the first movie that I wanted to see again.
Right.
Because once you were in on the scares, you wanted someone to...
Sure.
be like, this guy's going to jump out of his...
You wanted to be able to nudge and be like, get ready.
This is going to be really... Be my own film critic. Let me tell you what this movie is about. But that's what Star Wars had, too. It had that return, you know...
It truly gave me some. There's a lot of collective pieces as to why I did stand up comedy, and there's so many pieces of music and theater and film and just everything kind of came together for me and helped me to define what it is that I think I loved.
Right. And were you the in what I was reading about you? You didn't gravitate towards sports at all. Did you gravitate towards theater or musical theater?
I have a joke from way back in my early comedy repertoire where I said I tried out for football in high school and I played for one play. I said I got hit so hard it knocked me right into West Side Story. I was a song and dance man. I was singing Yankee Doodle Dandy with a bedazzled vest on literally minutes after that hit.
Well, that's where all the girls were.
I was such an introvert. My first mentor was, his name was Frank Roberts, and he was my drama teacher at Arlington High School. And this man truly changed my entire life. I had no belief system. I didn't have the kind of dad that was, he didn't know how to encourage.
Right.
He just didn't do it like that.
Uh-huh.
My mom was, but I needed that guy belief.
Right.
And I was my dad's only son, and he was an athlete. He was an all-around, like, you know, he was an A-plus player, and so I wasn't following in his path. He didn't know how to talk to me, and Frank Roberts came along, and he was the first person to say, I truly see something in you, and I want to help to build your confidence.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I did Anything Goes. I played Billy Crocker, and I was singing and dancing.
That's great.
Did Grease, Danny Zuko. It was a great start to this unbelievable ride I've been on.
And so what did your fam, when you, so you were they supportive when
they
you were
left
doing
me.
All the,
no.
What did your sisters think? Did you get along with your, I mean, that's a lot of girls in the house.
It was, yeah. Jeez. Everybody,
it was
almost like they were supportive, but even my family knew I was so shy that they kind of were like trepidatious in saying like, go for it. Only my mother was always had just a deep, deep belief. Like, whatever you put your heart into, you will find success in. So she was a champion, but the rest of the family, it took a little while. They'd come see me do stand-up, and they'd be like, that is you up there. Wow. Yeah, you're doing it.
That's what families do. My mother would always say to me, don't people know that these are things you've been doing since high school? Like, in the kid, you know, they're not funny. Like, it would be like that I was putting, it was always like that I was putting one over on people.
Sure. And what is so interesting is I remember hearing an interview with Johnny Carson, 1968, and he said, you use everything. You use everything you've ever learned in your life. He said, something you did when you were five, you'll use it someday. It's all prep for the show.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Do you have like a bit that you save up and you go, oh my God, I finally get to bit? Or
yeah, I mean, I can look at a lot of the very... I mean, I had like... I'm not a joke teller. I'm more of a storyteller. But I had like jokey jokes. I remember writing a joke in high school that I performed in 1990 when I started stand-up. And I think I said, my grandfather used to make sculptures out of macaroni and cheese. Pause. It was a wonderful craft.
I like it. I think that's a good one.
Destined for stardom.
Yes. You knew. And who... So you describe yourself as a storyteller. Who was the storyteller growing up? Or did you... I always feel like... Do you feel... I grew up in New England, and it's so cold. It's sort of like Canada.
Right.
You sort... Everybody is a pretty good storyteller. Well, all my Italian relatives were.
Yeah. We, you know, it was that thing of... I don't know if they...
Get to be funny.
Get to be on the stoop. Everybody meets on the stoop at night, and everyone's sitting on someone's porch. And when you jump in, you remember that feeling of, okay, it's my turn to add something. And you either killed or bombed. And if you bombed, it was like, who's got the next, who's going to save him?
Yeah.
So I always found that when it was my turn to interject something, I wanted to have it polished and kind of ready to go.
Your story ready to go.
Yeah. That was the one thing I do remember about, we had a dysfunctional family. My dad drank. There was a lot of... kind of like fear in my house, but we dealt with everything through humor.
Right.
Every single thing. And not just like a joke to break the monotony. Like we laugh at some pretty dark shit.
Yeah.
We could break our way out of anything.
I think you have to. Do you feel like currently today, you know, when I wrote my book and it was my childhood was very chaotic.
I wish it was here.
I know. I wish you could read it. You're going to have this copy.
It's to a very take special copy.
You get snacks and the free book.
Thank you. I'll sign it.
Thank you. That would be good. But I remember, you know, I wrote these stories, and to me, they're hysterical. People started to read it. They were like, I'm so, it's child abuse. I was like,
it's incredibly
no,
dark.
It's funny. Yes. I thought it was I meant it to be funny.
Oh,
I'm okay.
I didn't know I was abused until I was in therapy. And my therapist one day was like, that's abuse. I'm like, oh, no, I just thought it was kind of like hazing. And he's like, no, that is terrible. He's like, it's truly defined your boundaries and how you feel about people.
Yes.
It's interesting what has propelled us
forward. I did, in doing my research, the one thing that I was like, that would scare me was when your dad would get drunk and come into your room late at night. Like, so that would scare me, like,
yes.
Sitting on the edge of the bed.
Yep.
Like, let me tell you about.
Yeah. I refer to it as like the drunk dad talk show, because he'd pull you into the kitchen. You were his guest, and he'd sit there with his beer and cigarette. And
so
it was like an interview about your week, and then his responses were going to be like 9 minute long, you know, rants on.
Yes.
Life is unfair.
That's so interesting. My dad did that too. He drank everything out. This is just tea. But he drank everything out of a cup.
Okay.
So I thought he was just drinking coffee, and I didn't understand why the conversation would just start going really downhill.
Tilting sideways.
It was the same thing. It would be like suddenly like wanting to examine my homework.
Yeah.
And it would go downhill.
It was good for us when I was 14. My parents separated, and it was the beginning of like, just that was like, you know, happy days are here again.
Yeah.
The house changed. It flipped. It was the most positive. It was creative.
Uh-huh.
And so, and then my relationship with my dad actually improved greatly as we figured it out over the years. But yeah, I remember, and again, through humor, my parents got separated.
Mm-hmm.
The last night my dad was in the house, it was like the police had to come. It was really stressful. And I remember like, laying on my mom's bed with my brother, my little sister was still a baby, my sister Kelly,
mm-hmm.
and it's quiet, you know, we're just sitting there, and finally my mother said, I think I'm ready to start dating.
And it was just, my God, like, she couldn't wait.
We just laughed, and it was just, again, humor broke up this, you know, impossible situation.
So did she go on dates?
Yeah. No, no, she'd go on dates. Like? She'd bring dudes home, and I had the room underneath hers, and she had a water bed. So sometimes in the middle of the night, it was like high tide.
Oh, so what movies are you seeing? So in this, processed everything through film.
Okay, so many, like, I'll speed round it. Like,
yeah.
Gene Wilder performances and
best.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I loved it because, in similar, again, to Mr. Jerry Lewis, is like, there was something so dark in his performance and intimidating and yet light and beautiful.
Yes.
And I like that kind of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I try to emulate that kind of swagger and style of comedy. So I remember seeing movies like that. And I remember my father took me to see, we'd seen Rocky, and he wanted to take me to another boxing movie. So he took me to Raging Bull.
Oh, my God.
But he didn't realize it was,
so violent.
It was so violent. And he, for the rest of his life, he did not like Robert De Niro because of the, language. And I was like, his language? What about your language? You're the one with the language. And so I remember seeing that. And then I remember watching movies like Cannonball Run.
Yes.
Nice.
And just loving that you could see it was kind of there. Ah, they're just playing here.
Yeah.
But I think what had a greater impact was I saw my mom on Christmas took me to Fresh Pond Movie Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and took me to see E.T.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just gone shopping for Christmas presents that night. The car was full of presents. We went and saw the movie. I was completely spellbound. I had a million questions. We came out. Our car had been stolen, and all our gifts were stolen.
Oh, my God.
And my mom, it was this thing of, like, I was on this high from this movie to, like,
wow.
She had, like, a full-on panic attack.
Yeah.
And we just sat on the steps of the movie theater waiting for my sister to come pick us up, and it was just an amazing conversation, and I remember it made such an impact because of what had happened that night.
Yeah. That's so interesting. You know, for people that act, that is a classic example of sense memory,
mm-hmm.
of not pre-preparing, like, I'm going to do the scene this way.
Right.
Because that's the classic thing. You go from a high door, something happens to you, And how incredibly sad and scary that, you know, that must have been.
I think it was weirdly, it was almost...
Like the world's a dangerous place.
It is. But that was an example of how within performance with this movie and how it kind of filled me up, that there can be gravity and darkness and fear. And I think all those things informed how I would behave on stage someday. Mm-hmm.
Did you... think about being an actor before being a stand-up, or did you always want to be a stand-up?
I knew I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. I always felt like, even at a young age, that it would have been like kind of it's like you can almost audition every night, you know, if people come to see your show. But I would sneak up and watch Johnny Carson almost every night. I'd watch the monologue with my mom, and I didn't even know what a lot of the jokes meant, but I loved him. Mm-hmm. I just could not, I studied him.
Yeah.
And they'd be laughing and I'd be like, okay, but now he's saying he's not funny. Now he's now he's telling everybody that joke was bad. He's ripping up a cue card. And I loved that it was real.
Yeah.
And I loved that, again, Johnny Carson, a darkness, a certain kind of edge in him, but still a lightness. I just ate it up. And I knew I wanted to be a comedian. I told my family, I think initially when I was like 12, I think I said, I want to do that someday.
Wow.
I never wanted to do anything else that I can remember.
And then some of the comedians, I know you like Steve Martin, Martin Short.
Sure.
Did you see Steve Martin in concert?
I didn't, but my sister Kelly did. And she saw him at Madison Square Garden. I was 15. She came home. She told me the story.
Yeah.
And I said to my sister Kelly that night, I'm going to play Madison Square Garden someday. You're going to come see your brother play there.
Oh, my God.
And it
That's
was one
amazing.
Of the greatest moments to be able to
find. So where does that confidence come from?
You know, I got to tell you, I think
or
it was a lot of...
just dreaming?
It was a lot of self-actualizing. I really believe in that. You know, people say manifesting, but I truly believe that when you make that, when you put something down on paper and you make it real, that there's that cooperation from the universe element.
Yeah.
And I really think that the best moments of your life are the ones that you hope to fulfill and then kind of create.
Right. And then so that night when you're there, does it make you emotional at all when you're there? Because it makes me when I'm like, I'm here. I watched him on TV and now I'm working with him.
It's
Do you have the presence of mind to take it in? And
I don't know what happens to me when I'm performing or around people that I admire, but I kind of click into this mode of like, we're equal, and it's a comfortable thing. I'm more comfortable with my peers, in a sense, and I didn't feel like I had as much in common with, you know, maybe just my other classmates. I wanted to be with the drama people, and we spoke a language
and
we understood. So I think that's part of the makeup.
I heard that you had gone out to dinner with Steve Martin and then just sort of talked to him and he's got that great book Born Standing Up.
That's right.
And did you reach out to him or did you know him through the years just to?
He sent me a copy of the book.
That's so nice.
And I didn't get it. Apparently, it went to the wrong address or something.
Somebody stole your book.
So somebody had said, oh, did you get the book by Steve Martin? I said, what? No, I read it. I bought it myself, but I didn't get it. And said, oh, he sent it to you. And then, can he email you? He emailed me. He's like, you didn't get the book? I said, no. He goes, I'll send you another book. So then he sent me a book with something nice written. Then the first book arrived. So I have two books with two different...
Oh, great.
You know, nice. And the thing that he said, which was, I don't know if I've ever even shared it, but it said, you're the only person who might understand all of this.
Wow.
And I was like just staring at this book by myself in my office for like an hour. Like, I can't believe, you know, that this gentleman just wrote me. And I asked to have lunch with him and he did. So we sat down and talked a little bit.
And what were the things that were most surprising about him?
Oh, well, I had heard that he was, you know, kind of also an introvert or maybe not like the most, not what you see on TV.
Right.
And I will tell you, I get that way too. I get kind of a little quiet. And so I knew going in, like, I should have some questions prepared. I should do some research.
Both going to be quiet.
Yeah. And it was for the first like 5 minutes. And I remember he gave me he said, kind of, you know, hey, and I sat down. He said, brought you a copy of my banjo CD. I said, oh, cool. And I remember I put it right there. And then it was like, you know, we kind of had to ease into this conversation.
Yeah.
And then finally, I think I asked a question. He said to me, he goes, you look like you really love it up there. And I said, I really do. And he goes, yeah, I never had that.
Interesting.
He said, I never had that. And I had known, I'd read The Death of My Father in the New Yorker, the article that he'd written. Yeah. And I was fascinated by that because he had a contentious relationship with his dad. I you know, could understand that. And so it was that thing of like, wow, he never had that praise. He never had that belief of you're really good. You're you're shining in something. So we sat there for about another half hour. And still, it was, you know, pretty you know, level, kind of even conversation. And then the first funny thing he said was he looked at me and he looked down at the CD and he goes, have you listened to it yet? I said, no, I have not. You know, okay. And it was just great. I got to ask him, you know, he was like my Yoda, to bring it back to Star Wars, of comedy. You know, this guy broke it wide open. Arenas. Yeah. I wanted to entertain as many people at one time as I could to emulate one of my heroes.
Right.
And so it was great. It was not what I expected, but I mean, whoever really is once you meet them in this crazy racket.
Yeah, and he also, you know, transferred to doing great film roles.
Yes.
And goes from like doing The Jerk. Do you have a favorite Steve Martin movie?
I mean, really, there's not like one I don't like. I mean, yeah, I really love
The Jerk.
I love The Jerk. And I think that, you know, certain comedians and choices that they've made, Robin Williams and Jim Carrey. I mean, sometimes people ask me, why aren't you doing more comedies? And truth be told, not that I didn't enjoy making the movies that I made, but I didn't want to be derivative and I wanted to grow. And I knew if I continued to kind of do the same thing, that it might be problematic down the road. So just focused on my stand-up, which I love doing every night. And now I'm just excruciatingly patient with, you know, trying to find great material.
Right.
You know?
Did you ever see him in – well, there's always that trajectory where comedians go get serious. And so he does a bunch of comedies. And then he does – have you seen Pennies from Heaven?
Yes.
Where it's so – I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
But it's so dark. It's troubling. It's difficult to watch.
Well, I love that. I really do. I love troubling and difficult to watch. It's my comfort zone.
That would be a good review for you.
It's like Holidays at Home when I was a kid. It just – Yeah, no, I mean, I truly, you know, Sunshine, Eternal Sunshine, A Spotless Mind, when Jim Carrey
turned that
corner. Obviously, Good Will Hunting, Robin Williams, and
and
Jerry Lewis in The King of Comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, these were all moments that, you know, helped me kind of try to figure out, like, how could I do this? How could what are my strengths, and how could I
You know, I said that a thing about Jerry, that my favorite thing is that he's, to me, he's comedy and tragedy. He's the masks, and that, which form a kind of a pathos.
Yeah.
Have you ever met a comedian that doesn't have, like, a soft underbelly of sadness? Jerry said you can't be a great comedian without great sadness.
I think that we all are broken in some way. I think that, you know, as many performers are, there's I met with Larry Moss, the acting, you know, great acting instructor. And I sat down with him one day. I had as a birthday gift, my former manager gave me a session with him, a couple of hours. And he said to me something that was so prolific and spoke to pretty much my life. He said, you know, the hole from your youth? He said, stop trying to fill it. You know, show people. Let people know that void.
Yeah.
And that's where the strength and the power comes from.
Wow, that's
and so that was very, it's interesting because as we're talking, I remember Dave Chappelle, when I first started, we were doing colleges together, 93, 94. And it was, Dave would even say, the power is in the silence. The power is in the quiet.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so cool and interesting, and I learned a lot from watching him even as we were young kids.
Yeah, that's pretty courageous, you know, but once you get that, you know, to not blur through moments, like live moment to moment, in the moment. Now, another person you mentioned who I worked with and I loved is John Ritter. Now, was this John Ritter from the television show or John Ritter in film? Because he did movies, but he didn't cross over quite as much.
Yeah, no, I'd seen the films, but I loved Three's Company.
Yeah, he was great.
It was like my babysitter. It was my friend. You know, in certain shows that when they would come on, it was like, yeah, these are my friends. I'm going over to see, you know, Jack and Chrissy and the gang. But I just loved the commitment. I loved not only the commitment, but you could see that he was even pushing himself even further with certain pratfalls and, you know, doors swinging. And But when he was sincere, I was drawn to that. Mm-hmm. I was drawn to people that could be brave. Mm-hmm. If you could be brave physically or brave with words,
yeah.
I wanted to be with you. I wanted to figure out how to do that because I did not know how to confront.
Mm-hmm. He had great physicality too.
The best. Yeah. Amazing physicality. I remember, I don't know why, side story, but I was in Maui some years back, 10 years back, and I was rented a little villa, and I went down there just to have a little vacation time, and the manager came in and said, this is a very special villa. I said, why is that? And he goes, this is where John Ritter always stayed.
Aww.
And I thought it was the coolest. The vacation was that much better because this was his spot.
And did you ever get to meet John Ritter?
I sadly did not. Ugh. No. I wish that I could have told him.
He was wonderful. I did a movie with him, and he was very difficult to work with because I laughed. So he had a great thing. One of his best things was walking into a room with a kind of shocked look. Mm-hmm. Like, that was his thing. Like,
yeah. Like, and why are you just, all here?
Yeah. That was, like, one of his good things. And I was like, John, don't. I can't look at you if you're going to do that. But I love him in, of course, Problem Child. My child is Satan. Yeah. That was like my favorite.
Problem Child, and then even Sling Blade, you know, in his that cameo. In
Bad Santa.
Bad Santa. But when he was at the door in Sling Blade and the door opens and he has that, you know, emotional moment, it makes my throat close. I mean, he was wonderful. A wonderful performer. Dynamic.
He was. Now, I also read that you had problems, which sound hard to believe. Overcoming.
You read I have problems?
Yes. No, overcoming.
Shit. It's out
no,
there.
Overcoming anxiety. And,
yeah.
And was this from the beginning or did you develop it?
So no, when I was in my mom's womb, she was phobic. She had
phobias. So it's in your DNA.
Yeah. So I was growing in her with her fear, absorbing it. She couldn't leave the house. Agoraphobia, I believe.
Yes. Is that?
And she had to force herself to take me in a stroller and bring me outside. So I had a lot of that. I had a lot of, on the way to school, there was a tree called the throw-up tree. And if I could make it past the throw-up tree without throwing up, I could probably make it to school. But most days I was leaning on it and I was sick at the idea of being around other people and being called on. Even thinking of it now, I remember that feeling that I would get.
Yes.
And so I had a lot of work to do to get past that place. But the first time I got on stage was in high school. It was as Billy Crocker and Anything Goes. Yeah. And I remember standing on the second tier of the you know, prop ship.
Uh-huh.
And I really actually had a conversation with myself where I said, this door's going to open. The light is going to hit me.
Yeah.
I have to sing. Mm-hmm. I never sang in front of more than 10 people, and there's 1,000 people in this auditorium. I said, I'm either going to shine right now, or I'm going to suck really, really bad. And I remember feeling that. And then the door opened, and something just took over. It's always been there. I've always felt even more together on stage than off.
Yeah, I agree. That's my favorite thing is between action and cut. Everything before and after I hate. But my favorite thing is acting, you know, that moment. And
it's like it keeps us contained or something. I don't know. It's like you can't ruminate too much. It focuses us in such a way that's almost hard to really explain to people that don't do it.
I think some of it is focus. I mean, for me, too, some of it is my crazy, chaotic childhood, and I feel like nobody can hurt me between action and cut. There's a certain, like, safety.
Sure.
I could cry, I could yell, I could hit someone,
yeah.
all under the mask of, you know, of a scene or something like that.
You're being invited to play.
Yeah.
You know, to act out.
And it's safe. That's what I always feel like. Sometimes it can be horrible, and they're like, you know, when it's lunch and you have to
yeah.
a minute to do a scene. The other thing that I thought was amazing about you is you talking about going to New York City.
Yes.
And like just going on stage, open mic, and being a comedian. Like, that just takes amazing courage.
It was the first time I performed stand-up was at Catch Rising Star in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it was an open mic. I went to watch. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I could do it yet. I still had that feeling of, like, I don't know if I can even walk towards the stage and feel my legs.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in the third row. And the way they used to do it back during their kind of potluck era was they'd pick the names that the people that signed up the week before out of the hat the next week. Mm-hmm. And it was just a way to get you to come every week with people because right. you may get picked.
Yeah.
So I was sitting there for about 40 minutes, and then finally the host of the show said, pulled out a name. He goes, "Where's Ernest Glenn?" Nobody moved. It was about 2 seconds of just solid silence. He goes, "Ernest Glenn?" And my hand went up. And he pointed at me. He goes, "You're Ernest Glenn?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "All right, here's your intro. All the way from the third row, Ernest Glenn." So my first set ever was as Ernest Glenn at Catch a Rising Star, and I was immediately hooked. I felt amazing up there. I got a couple of laughs off my silly notions, and I could not have been more confident in that moment. Right. Walking off, I just felt amazing. Yeah. I could look forward to doing it again and trying to figure out how to be better.
So when you were in, because yeah,
and thank you, Ernest Glenn, because I never heard of him again. Facebooked. I've tried to find him. I want to thank him for not showing up that night.
That should be the name of your book.
Thank you, Ernest Glenn.
I'll have him write the foreword.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about, because you said you had problems. I won't get to that, but problems writing a book and stuff. Because you should definitely write a book. But so when you're doing, and who are some of the people that you're doing? You mentioned Dave Chappelle, but who are some of the people that you're doing stand-up with at the time?
Okay, so Jeff Ross. Uh-huh. Was in the Village at the time. We were down there on...
Is this the 90s or the 80s?
So I went to New York in 93, 94. Right. I started in 1990. Mm-hmm. And then I went to New York for the first time after doing it a couple of years in Boston and, you know, earning my badge, so to speak, of like, okay. But New York was the validation. If you went to New York and if they liked you, it was almost like you should keep going with this. If not, be a local act and, you know, make a few shekels here and there. So I went and did my first spot in 93, 94. I was on a show with a few people on the show were like Dave Chappelle, Jim Brewer. And Chappelle was like 15 at the time. I think I was 19. He was 15. He was amazing. Yeah.
And wasn't Jay Moore sort of in the periphery?
Jay Moore was there. And, oh, man, it was like just immediately I felt like, oh, I'm being elevated because everybody was so good. And it was a new era of comedy. Yeah. It was
comedy
a new
was
generation.
In.
Comedy was back after languishing and through, you know, the 90s was not good, actually. It was a good time to start because nobody was paying attention. The 80s was it.
Yeah.
The boom. Yeah. The stars. Johnny Carson. And then it was like the 90s oversaturation, and you had to really do something unique to even survive.
Yeah. What about that thing? I was a stand-up for like a minute and a half.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. Literally
you had
a minute
and a half of material?
Yeah, that was about it.
Pretty much.
I won a contest. This is my story on Letterman. This was the first time I was on Letterman. I told the story.
Okay.
Because I worked. Kerry Hoffman hired me at Stand Up New York.
Yes.
And I did 5 minutes or whatever. It was like one of these stupid contests, like if you work at a hotel, you know. So anyway, I won the contest, and he said to me that, you know, if you win this thing, you get, you know, you'd be on Letterman. And I won, and I was like, this is incredible. I'm so naive. I was like, when do I get to be on Letterman? He goes, no, you misunderstood. What I meant was you win the thing, you work out here, you send you around the country, and someday you'll be on Letterman.
Oh, God.
So years later, I was on Letterman, I told that story.
Oh, I said,
it took years, but Kerry Hoffman was right. But it was I was an actor. I just was like, I was in a sketch comedy thing. And I was like, how hard could this be? But for me, it was like the minute I had to go on a train to Mount Vernon to do a show and get back at midnight as a girl, I was like, how do people do this?
Yeah.
So tell me about that experience of, and then the other thing, it was like, I know this is going to sound like, that's called being a comedian. But, you'd have to go downtown to the Comedy Cellar and then go up to the East Side. I was like, who's got the money to do ride the subway that many times?
Whatever your spot pay was kind of like going to pay for you to get to the next location. Because there was Dangerfields and the Strip and the Store and Stand Up and the Improv and you know, later Gotham, the Boston Comedy Club, Comedy Cellar. I was doing 6 to 9 shows a night.
I mean, that's incredible to me.
and I'd go till 3 o'clock in the morning. If I started a new bit at 8, it was finessed by 3 in the morning. I would just do it all night until it got funny or not.
Yeah. Well, that to me, again, is the difference between, because if I got a laugh, I just was like, great, now yeah. I can go home and tell my roommate. Like, that's all I cared about, right. getting one laugh.
Yeah.
But the idea that you'd have to do it again, I was like, right. I don't think I'll ever get that laugh.
And
right.
that is why, for me, I liked the style of comedy that also included, you know, improvisation. I was in sketch groups and stuff in Boston, too. So I liked feeling like the show wasn't like a rigmarole and I'm repeating. And I watched guys like Seinfeld and I was like, this guy's, you know, brilliant. Mm-hmm. But that's not what I do. His is about haiku. It's almost like very specific real estate for each word. I was of that Johnny Carson idea of like, I just want it to feel real, even if it's not the funniest.
Right.
I just want to feel present. Mm-hmm. And so I worked on that when I was, did about 2.5 years in New York City before I came out to the West Coast, pretty much by accident, and then never left also by accident. But those 2.5 years defined me.
I'm not sure when we met, but we met in this movie, which neither of us have seen, called Flypaper.
96?
I think so.
96.
I don't know much about it. I know that Lucy Liu is in it and she's naked with snakes.
I don't know because I didn't see it. I think I know I have a goatee in it and I think I was playing a detective
You were very sweet. We were in a hotel room with John C. McGinley, who's out of his mind in a good way.
Yep.
But later on there's a scene, I've never seen the movie, John C. McGinley. You guys are detectives or something? I don't know what it is. I hire somebody to because I'm engaged to be married. Yeah. I don't even know the story.
Oh, I had to look up this log line too because I was like, what is this movie that I did? Ready? This is how it's described. No, this is the best. Ready? When lust and dishonesty bring strangers together, their sexual escapades and kinky behaviors lead to violence and a twist ending.
Yeah. Yeah, they do, especially when John C. McGinley is behind the wheel of a car. So in that scene, I handcuff him.
The twist ending, by the way, you never saw because you probably left the theater before.
I've never seen the movie.
Before it twisted.
I have never seen it, so I don't know what happened.
Nor will we.
But it was cheers. It was bad enough I had to shoot it. But I did this thing with John C. McGinley, and you were in the scene. You were lovely. And then we shot in Laurel Canyon, and McGinley is supposed to be chasing me. He gets free.
Okay.
And he's chasing me through the genuine Runyon Canyon.
Okay.
And McGinley is like, I go, John, like, you know, he's off, like, I can't run this fast. Yeah. He goes, well, you're just going to have to. Like, I was like, I always said, it was the first time in my life, I was like, he's crazy. Like, he's going to hit me. And then they actually, we were in Laurel Canyon, and I remember I had to roll down this hill, like, for real. Like, they were like, no, it's just, we're just going to have
stunts.
A little piece of you. Yeah, the whole thing was crazy. And then there's another weird thing for movie lovers out there. I had to roll down the bottom of the hill, which was terrifying. And then we continued the fight scene through someone's house.
Oh.
And there's a woman who happens to be making her dinner. And
that's the twist ending.
I don't even know.
You've ruined someone's dinner.
I have not seen the movie. But anyway, we're shooting the scene. And I'm like, oh my God, it is a very sorry looking Carol Lynley. And who nobody knew. Carol Lynley was in the Poseidon Adventure.
Okay.
Under the Yum Yum Tree. But I was like, are you Carol Lynley? So I was more interested in talking to Carol Lynley. Anyway, Lucy Liu has sex with snakes. And just so I can get this out of the way, I years later ran into Lucy Liu on a movie that we were in. Look it up on IMDb. And she denied being in the movie. And then I said, we met. We were in a movie. And she said, no, we weren't. So Bill Murray and I have something in common.
I would challenge someone out there to find footage of Lucy Liu and her friend Snakes in the scene and maybe send it to her on Instagram and say, I love this film that you were in. You should make a sequel.
I remember that Robert Loggia was in the film.
That's right.
Anyway, I have not seen it. I think it's pretty hard to see.
I did two films at that time. I didn't even know how.
Were these your first films?
Yes.
Because this is way before Employee of the Month.
Yes, it was. But it was like, I don't even know how I got these movies.
I didn't even know you were a stand-up. I thought you were an actor.
I thought at that point, honestly, I had no business being on a movie set.
You were good.
I had good agents. I still knew, though, I was not ready.
Not that good. Come on. No, Dave, what did you see?
Well,
in
I got
movie?
A nobody.
No, I'm kidding.
I did that. I did a Rene Russo movie called Buddy. About a gorilla, a period piece, and I was a fair cop number two, and my line was Mrs. Lintz.
That's brilliant. I'll be
looking for that.
I called my mom. I said I'm in this movie. She said, "What are you doing?" I say Mrs. Lintz, and I have to say it with authority because I'm a cop. I'm a fair cop, and she's like, "Oh, is that how you'd be credited, the fair cop?" I said, "Well, I'm fair cop number two." She was like, "Baby, you need to be fair cop number one."
So, yes, we met, and then you became, and then the next time I saw you through a mutual friend, manager, you were like blowing up as a comic, and we went to see you. And I remember, again, and I didn't bring it with me, but I did get your autograph.
Oh, cool.
Because I collect autographs. And was there any concern? And then your career only took off from there. Was there any fear at that point? Because you were so happy. Like, that was when you were, it must have been incredibly exciting.
It was.
Was there any fear, like, uh-oh, am I going to be like Andrew Dice Clay? Is this going to have a ceiling?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't even like,
it was getting out of hand.
It was like, you know, okay, how much more time do I have up here on the peak? The top echelon. Yeah. I had read enough, you know, memoirs and biographies, and I was a student of the whole business. So I felt like I get it. This is cycles. This is, very high highs, and, you know, the pendulum always swings.
Right.
You know? So I knew I remember playing Madison Square Garden and thinking, like, this is it. This is like the very, very, you know, what am I going to do? Like the O2 Arena or something like that. And truly, I remember about a year after that tour, I was already like, okay, I need to change. I need to evolve. Mm-hmm. I don't want to even repeat what I just did. It was great. I loved it. But now let me try to figure out a new way to present an idea.
Right.
So it was thrilling. And it was prior to a very kind of dark time in my life. My parents both got cancer. They both passed away within 9 months of each other. Then I went through a theft thing with my brother, who was my business manager.
Wow.
So I had about 8 years
so weird.
Just, you know, good times, you know, the Dane train, as we lovingly called it, was rolling. And I was young and stupid and, you know, just green, but getting better. And I have nothing but great, great thoughts about that moment in my life.
So as I was preparing to do my interview, I happened to listen to the Marc Maron interview.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, I thought it was a little intense. You reminded me of like Al Pacino and Serpico.
Yeah, Maron was not in a good headspace that day.
Like, leave Al Pacino alone, okay? He did what he had to do. But it was like he would not.
Yeah.
And
he came to me later and he was like, I got a lot of shit for that interview. People think I was hard on you. I was like, you were.
He was. It was relentless.
Yeah, he was super kind of in a cynical headspace. Personally, I thought it was funny because, again, we thrive in like awkwardness and you know, maybe I felt a little bit of like a camaraderie because it's like, oh yeah, we both are, you know, alpha kind of competitive dudes but I enjoyed it. It was great to do that.
Do you think, I mean, I can only speculate because listening to the interview, it just comes off as jealousy. It just, the undercurrent of it is like that it was, you know, that confidence was perceived as arrogance.
Sure.
And because you were doing well and they weren't, it's easy to knock someone.
Hey, listen, comics are, you know, we are fragile, very fragile, like paper thin, sensitive, and again, competitive. It's an interesting place on the totem pole, stand-up comedy, and the sacrifice that we all make to do it, to sit at that table and gamble like on blackjack. Okay, when am I going to hit? When am I going to win? And am I? Am I going to bust? Mm-hmm. So I kind of understood it, and I also knew him for years at the Comedy Cellar, and he was always persnickety and never very friendly. So I didn't think I was going to get a new and improved version there, but I was still happy to have the conversation with him and hope to do it again.
It's definitely funny. I mean, because I love listening to other interviews, but every comic has that kind of, you know, whether it's Richard Pryor or Robin Williams, you know, you have great highs and great lows, and
that's
then
it.
They come back and do a special. And
that's it. It's
make
really
fun
up to
of
you.
Themselves.
It's up to you. It's it's how you, if you choose to meet it head on and kind of own it. And I do that in my new stand-up that I've been working on for the last couple of years for my, yeah. for my new specials, deeply personal, the most personal. But I also think it's the funniest
because yeah.
it's really real. And it's, some of it is like obtuse and wild and out there, but it's mine. It's yeah. really all my self-observation as opposed to just talking about what I see out there.
Well, one thing is that I think is amazing is about is your fans and how, again, you sort of created this fan base early yeah. on before there even was social media, you know, right at the beginnings. And it yeah. seems as if, again, your fans have totally, you know, just been with you and feel like you're part of the family.
Somebody wrote me an email like early on in my when I was playing a lot of colleges. And I played a lot of colleges, actually, because my dad, of all people, gave me some great advice when I first was starting. He said, play a lot of colleges. I said, you know, I didn't go to college. I don't, you know, why? And he mm-hmm. said, because the things that you discover in those years, you'll take with you for the rest of your life and you'll want to see and be a part of. And he knew that. He had a bit yeah. of a, you know, soothsayer moment of like seeing like what the, and so I did shows for years and somebody wrote me an email once and it literally in that one day I was like, man, I did it right, and I need to continue to do this. And the guy said, I feel like I've grown up with you. Mm-hmm. You were talking to me in high school, oh, you're talking to me in college, and you're talking to me now.
Wow, that's great.
And I
great.
Was like, oh, I came up with a generation of fans, and I just got to continue to share.
That's, you know, that's really interesting. That's mm-hmm. something to put in, you're right, to put in the back of your head, to kind of like if ever you go off of that, it can keep you sort of back on track.
Yeah.
I love that. Except yeah. that you didn't have kids or anything.
Didn't not yet.
That. Well,
see. Not yet. But, you know, I watched that Larry King interview with Jerry Lewis the other day because I've been just insatiably watching everything. And he talked about, what did he say? He was 66. Danielle came into yeah. his life. And he said, no one ever said that age, the calendar, and passion worked together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like, you know what? I'm 45, but I look forward to having a family someday. And
yeah.
now I feel like I'm actually ready. I feel like I'm all here.
Yeah.
You know,
that's great.
I used to search for myself a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, I had great therapy. And I went through this kind of awakening after my parents and my brother. And I finally came out of that as, I think, a better person and a better performer.
Mm-hmm. So some of the movies that you're in.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, I want to. No, I think it's great. Some of the movies that you were in, of course, Employee of the Month.
Yes.
And
my first leading man role.
I know.
That was so exciting.
Which is a funny movie. Yeah. Of course, it did slightly rip off my failed pilot. I'm not going to say anything. We had the same manager involved. No lawsuit. All is forgiven.
Lawsuit.
Is
you probably make $750.
I know.
No, it was a very ill-fated pilots.
Ileana Rama, yes, yeah, Supermarket of the Stars. But check it out, and then Rent, Employee of the Month.
Yeah.
But. The other movie, my favorite one is Dan in Real Life.
Oh, yeah.
That's a wonderful film.
Yes.
And so is that kind of movie kind of gone out of fashion? I feel like that was such a great movie.
Yeah.
There was a period where.
It felt even then like, oh, there, movies like this feels like noises off. Like we're in one house and people are coming in and out of rooms.
Yeah.
And an amazing Diane Wiest and John Mahoney and Juliette Binoche and on and on and on.
These, yeah.
You know, Alison Pill before people, just an amazing Leo Butz. Everybody, just a great, great cast, great mm-hmm. experience. And Peter Hedges, I'm very thankful because I wouldn't have had that part if he didn't come to see my show. He stood in line to you know to see the show, and he was talking to some of my fans, and he asked my fans, "Would you like to see Dane do something that's not funny?" And they said, yeah, yeah. He said, oh, would you like to see him do something maybe where he's vulnerable? And they're like, yeah, yeah. He said, your fans just gave you this role.
Wow.
And so he gave me a shot, and I'm very appreciative. And Steve Carell as well. He was equally as welcoming, and it was great to play the guy that loses.
That's my favorite performance of yours.
Oh, thank you.
So I don't know. It has a kind of, again, vulnerability.
Sure.
Unexpectedness. I just really love it. Yeah. I also like Mr. Brooks working with Kevin Costner. Did you like that? He's such a movie star.
So great. Yeah, he is. That's exactly it. You know, it's like, you know, it's
I
like
was Field a little of shy Dreams. Around him.
I'm like, oh my goodness, The Untouchables and so much, so many, many, many movies. And Bull Durham. And Guy's guy, but at the same time, could not have been more lovely. And my mom was sick at the time when I was making that movie, and he was just, he'd have his hand on my back from time to time, and he always had incredible quotes and advice, and he was funny. And again, very appreciative, because I was doing Employee of the Month. I went in my trailer. I made an audition tape. I sent it. I thought, this is never going to, you know, go anywhere. And Jeremy Plager, who was my agent at the time, CAA, brought it over to Kevin's house and said, you should watch this. And Kevin called me on set and said, you really want to do this? And I was like, yes. He's like, you nailed it. This is what I need. This is what I need to have you do. Can you come and, you know, participate? I said, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. It was great.
So when you're, what are some of the things you're learning about acting from doing these experiences, these sort of smaller?
Yeah, mostly from when you fuck up, somebody's like going to come to you and tell
like
you.
Like not being truthful, or what do you think, trying to be funny? Those are
David Slade was a director on a TV show I did with Betty White and Marie Osmond. That was the first TV show
that
I did.
That seems perfect for you.
Betty was my grandmother and Marie Osmond was my mom. Which, again, that was surreal because I watched Donnie and Marie growing up.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, Betty White is like, you know, just the best, you know, I don't think there's a better comedic, you know, sitcom performer in timing.
Yeah.
And we would be on set and she would say, have her coffee mug at the little bar, set there. And she would say, if I can't remember my lines, we used to do this on Golden Girls. We write them inside on tape. She goes, so when you see us sipping or looking at sugar packets on Golden Girls, we're actually reading certain lines that for some reason aren't sticking.
That's funny.
But I remember David Slade, I believe that was the director, came over to me one time and he said, you're indicating.
Ooh, that's
and
the worst.
I'd never heard it. I literally was like, okay. And then I went around. I was like, what does that mean? I'm indicating. And so I was learning from, you know.
Yeah.
From valuable lessons from mistakes. and I made a bunch, but piece by piece. And just always, I'm a student of whatever it is that I'm involved in. I love to listen. And most of the time, if we're not doing something like this or if I'm on a stage, I like to absorb and I like watching things about how people get to where they get to. And I can watch any documentary, ballerina. I don't care if you're an astronaut. Like, I'm buying it. I'm in. I want to know that journey.
Do you have favorite documentaries, or what movies do you watch to relax? Or do you have go-to movies that you enjoy?
To relax, Goodfellas. I mean, come on. It's like...
No, it's on 365 days a year.
It's wonderful. Here's what's incredible about that film, too.
Yeah.
Is every time I watch it, there's a scene in it where I'm like, I've never seen this scene.
Interesting.
This movie's growing. Are they adding? Is there like five cuts of this movie? There's always a scene that I'm like, what is this now? I don't remember this moment.
Yeah.
But a plethora of movies. I love great 80s movies. And again, Steve Martin, like Three Amigos. I can watch great comedies. Or a lot of John Hughes movies really gave me a boost. It's a vast list.
Mm-hmm. And do you have directors that you, I go through phases of directors I like. I've been telling people I'm on my John Frankenheimer. I like listening to commentaries. That's sort of my favorite thing. So I learn a lot about directing, listening to these commentaries.
Sure.
And even if it's something I'm not particularly interested in, like how to shoot a car scene.
Right.
I'm like, this is incredible. I don't know if I'll ever shoot a car scene, but John Frankenheimer is teaching me exactly shot by shot how to
great.
Do it. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who recently, got back into a Quentin Tarantino kick and just wanted to watch Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And I had the Anointed screenplay. The first script that I ever wrote was I would read Reservoir Dogs and learn how to form scenes from that from the screenplay. I actually just by happenstance, somebody said, you want to come play tennis? This is last summer. Uh-huh. I said, I don't play tennis. He goes, I trained Quentin Tarantino. I was like, I play tennis.
I play tennis.
I'm very good at tennis. I go, I have a racket and I have sneakers and balls. And we went and I got to play tennis with him and, you know, talk shop a little bit. And it was truly, again, self-actualizing moment. Cause I do remember early in my career writing that script and feeling like I want to share this idea with him someday.
Yes.
And I got to tell him, hey, I wrote a script based on, it was great.
Yes.
I was hoping he would say send it over, but instead he was like, just serve the ball. Let's, come on.
For
No, he was delightful. He is a big
movie fan. So yeah. I watched last night your film American Exit.
Oh yes,
and that has sort of aspects of it's got a father and son relationship. It's also sort of like a modern kind of a noir film.
Very much so.
And when did you shoot this?
I did this last summer with Levi Miller, plays mm-hmm. my son, and he's an extraordinary talent. I mean, when you talk about emerging young actors,
right.
and we've seen Momingers, and you've seen there's not a lot of discipline until action. I mean, this young man is it was a joy to work with him, mm-hmm. and we brought so much out of each other because he is the real deal. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting with his mom one day on the set, and I said, "Did you want him to do this?" She said, "No, he wanted to audition for Pan. He beat 3,000 kids he never acted.
Wow.
He's like a phenom. He's meant to do it."
Yeah.
And so I got to experience this, film where it was like I'd never played a father. I'd never played somebody dealing with an illness. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the stakes are raised because it's kind of a bit of a kidnapping type of film.
Yeah, it turns dark.
It turns really dark. And all the things we've been talking about today and kind of everything that I experienced growing up living as an adult child of an alcoholic, I put into this guy.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like I really got to do something in a space that I wasn't sure if I'd ever be asked to participate
in. And how did they think of you for the part?
Mm.
Because I wouldn't have...
The script was sent to me a year earlier, and of course, I never got it. My agents maybe were like...
That's Steve Martin book.
I was like I was offered it, and there was another actor that they got.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 days before they were to shoot, he bailed. He said, "I got another gig over in Europe, and I got a family, and it's better money, and this is, mm-hmm. this is not going to cut it." And they begged him to stay. He couldn't. And then they called me, and I met with him that night. And 5 days later, we started the film.
Wow.
Yeah. So prep time was like,
yeah,
I'm going to play all these things that I've never, had a chance to really reflect on, mm-hmm. But probably helped. Because it was really organic and it was really very real and present in these moments with Levi. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really lovely movie, and we're in all the festival. Maybe we're lining up to hopefully get into a festival somewhere.
Yeah,
and I hope it has its moment because it's a nice film.
Well, it's very your relationship with him in the film is great and wonderfully realized, and it's a beautiful film and it does have a twist. As I said, it gets a little sad, very sad, sure. Unexpected.
Yeah, it's convoluted in the way that I think you want to.
It's like these film noir.
Yeah, you're investing in these people that are fragments of their total self, and you're not given everything is not. I like movies that are not tied up all neat with a bow. Mm-hmm. This is makes you want to talk about after. Do you like me? Do you not? Did you mm-hmm. where did you start and where did you finish? And those are the kinds of conversations I hope to continue to be a part of.
So, what kind of movies going forward do you sort of see yourself wanting to be in? Is it serious or funny or both? Or?
Well, I'm still so active and physical that when I see movies like John Wick, I mean, that's a role that I would love to be able to play. I do Krav Maga. I've always been, into, just staying healthy and physical. So I see a role like that and I go, okay, that would be kind of a cool, to do like a real hardcore action type film.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been something that I hope to work on someday.
I had watched for my TCM research, I always have to watch a lot of movies for work. And it's funny when you watch a movie for work versus pleasure.
Right.
And so for work, I had to watch Back to the Future.
Yeah.
But it's such an amazing movie.
So good.
And I said, why don't they make movies like this anymore that are kind of funny, but that they're slightly action adventure?
Yeah, no, it's that's one of my favorite movies.
Isn't that
I think
a
that's
great
kind of a perfect.
Film?
It's perfect. It's like the screenplay.
Robert
Zemeckis, and there's a great documentary you can actually find online with him in it.
Oh yeah,
it's not very long. It's about 40 minutes talking about how it came together and all the people that passed on it and how Michael J. Fox got involved. It was almost set up to fail, but it had legs.
Yeah. Well, I like that kind of, I could see you in a movie like Back to the Future.
Oh, man.
That would be a fun one.
I like all different kinds of. Talked to Kevin Costner once about a Western.
Yes.
Potentially doing something like that. I was like, all right, cool. I grow a cool beard for that. I'm open to. I read everything. I'm an insatiable reader, and I talked to Neil LaBute a few years ago about maybe doing
coming back
and doing Broadway, and we were going to do Fat Pig, and unfortunately, it fell apart. I don't know. I love stand up and I still do it every night. Mm-hmm. And I'm as excited about it 28 years later as the first time I did it.
Right.
And it keeps me happy until something else that really challenges me comes along.
Right. So my last question for you is because you were in a lot of rom-coms and I love romantic comedies.
Yep.
And the movie that I wrote that I'm going to be directing is kind of a very modern twist on the romantic comedies. But what do you think why can't we have romantic comedies in the way that we used to? What happened? What's going on with men and women?
Is it like... Oh, what is going on with men and women? That's, watch my stand-up. I talk a lot about it because I absolutely feel like...
It's such
a deep conversation to get
loaded.
Into. But to keep it surface, it's like, yeah, there's something...
we're disconnected.
It's disconnected, yes.
So therefore, maybe you can't... That's what I think. I go, if we can't figure things out in real life, we can't make movies about them.
But most of people's life now is not... It's unrealistic, a lot of those scenes, because people are texting. Everything's text. Everything is like texting until you're texting during sex. You're sexting as you have sex.
I know in my day, which was when I was in school in the 80s, there pretty much was a plan, and I don't think it had changed from the 1950s.
Yeah.
You went on five or six dates.
That's right.
And then you had sex. And,
yeah.
And you progress from there. And it's so nothing before it even came up.
Right.
Somebody would say, do you want to go to a movie? You go to a movie. If the movie went well, you go, my friend's having a party next week. Do you want to go to the party?
Yeah.
There was an unspoken. And when I talk to young people now, I'm like, they don't know what's going on.
Yeah. No. And they don't participate in the waiting game anymore. It's like if you don't text... Within an hour of when I texted you, it's like, oh, you don't like me very much. Okay.
Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Exactly. Swipe left. The rom-com, I don't think, has its... Somebody has to do a really smart one that kind of speaks to what, people are experiencing now.
Yes, putting modern... Well, that's what I've tried to do, is like the modern man and woman in the old-fashioned... Because nobody really wants to get married anymore, and nobody really... knows what love is. And
because look at the track record of it. It's not exactly the most desirable statistic out there of who finally, goes the distance. And by the way, it's like, it's scary because so many people are, you see it on the news. It's like divorce. It's so expensive and it's a battle.
Oh,
I think it just intimidates people to, why have that if potentially it could go south and now I'm suffering in my life?
Yeah.
No.
Well, a good friend of mine was talking to me. He was like, he goes, I'm engaged. I'm going to get married. I'm like, that's fantastic. He goes, as soon as we, we can figure out all the prenup stuff and we're going to get, like, as if that's just part of it.
That's right. And I believe in that, though. It's like, come on. You come with what you brought. This should be the deal. Whatever you bring.
Books too.
It's yours.
Everything.
Everything. Whatever I bring. Whatever we mutually together acquired, then that we split up. Very simple.
You just
have to do an audit.
It's just a shame that it has to be. I guess I'm too old fashioned. It has to be all written down.
So romantic, you two. I can't stand it.
What about I keep saying my final question. This is my final question.
We didn't get to talk
question.
About Jerry that much.
Well, you're going to have to come back.
I will come back.
In closing, what was your favorite thing about Jerry? And what did you learn from him?
Oh, man. Okay. So, Jerry, I had seen his show when he was performing down on Wilshire Boulevard there, that theater. Because he did the silent movie theater and then he did a second show. And he said, where are you? I said, I got to go do my show now. And he said, where is it? And I said, it's up at the Laugh Factory. He goes, I'm going to go. I'm bringing Danielle and we're going. And he came to the Laugh Factory and he came into the lobby. And I think he was 88.
Yeah.
And he goes, I've been in show business for 84 years. And I've never been into a comedy club to see a comedian. You're my first. I was like, wait, didn't you perform? He goes, no, we did nightclubs. We did, you know, ballrooms. We did. He's like, I've never seen a stand-up comedian in a stand-up comedy club. And I was the first.
Wow.
And a friend of mine, thank God, took a picture. Jerry gave me a standing ovation at the end. And I have this picture in my office of him beaming. And I had just a very special connection, as I know that you do as well, with this guy who, with open arms, just invited me into his life.
And we were both at his handprint footprint, which I couldn't believe.
Yeah.
We were. I said, what do you mean you don't have a handprint footprint? I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it was nuts.
So I'm so glad that that happened, and we're both in flanking him with Richard Lewis. And he's great. I'll be thinking of him pretty much every day, especially when it comes to performing.
Well, I'll be thinking of him every day because he called me one day, and he told me to write this down, and I keep it on my desk.
Okay.
He said... because I was having I was in a rough patch. He goes, why are you feeling, you know, out of it? I show business. Come on, it's brutal. And he goes, get a pen and get paper. I said, okay. And he goes, all right, are you ready, Dane Cook? Ready? The Jew in the desert's gonna tell you. And I go, okay. And he made me write this down. He said, when you're feeling negative, he goes, I want you to read this every day. Keep it on your desk. I am a very smart man. I am an important individual. And I was like, wow, thank you so much. And he said, you know, he just, you know, wow. I can't get to.
I know.
He was just a great mentor and friend.
I'll say what he said to me was, because I do the same thing. I said, well, you know, I'm nervous. I got to meet these. I have an audition or something. I said, I'm kind of nervous. What do you have to be nervous about? You know, I was like, well, he's a big director and I want to be in the movie, you know. And he goes, all you need to do is show up. You're perfect. And I thought, I wish parents would say something like that, because it's like the way he said it with such gravitas behind it. It sounds simplistic, but it's like, we're perfect. You know, like when we go to an audition, there's no you don't have to be, it's not about whether you're good or bad or get the job or don't get the job. You're perfect. You're a human being. And,
and
you know, he had so much of that in spades. But I love that quote. That's amazing. Well, anyway, thank you so much, Dane, for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you. This was really
so
wonderful.
Much.
Please come back.
It's my pleasure.
Anytime. Our first live show.
I know. Exciting.
This was live?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
We did it.
You can find Dane on Twitter and Instagram at Dane Cook. His website is danecook.com. His special Troublemaker airs on Showtime October 17th.
It's just still been. It's been airing.
It's going to air again on October 17th.
Oh,
and
also you've ruined the
live
show.
I got a residual check now.
Look for him on American Gods on Stars. Thank you very much. And you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon. It's out in paperback.
Not this one.
Please like our Facebook page. The website is ileanaspodcast.com.
That's us.
That was great.
Thank you. And as I always say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning and a middle and an end. And this is the end of our show today. Dane Cook was in my movie today. Thank you so much,
Absolutely.
My dear. Good friend. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks, bye, everybody. See you next time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.